This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Comforting, that's the Shabbos Nachamu, it's the Shabbos Acharei Tisha B'Av, and to review some of the points that I've made in a shiur about 12 years ago that I gave on the subject. And we in fact advertised the title as that, but the newspaper somehow disagreed and decided not to publish our advertisement, which left me free to change the title. So we can do two things tonight. Those of you who want to hear the shiur I was going to give can order the tape from 12 years ago. which is available, and so that way you'll get the Shabbos Nachamu shiur. But in addition, after this morning's shiur to the ladies, which was an opening to Shir Ashirim, and which has a tie-in with the Seder, as I'll show you, I decided it was more important perhaps to work on some of that material in the shiur as well. The first paragraph of the Shema, that we say twice a day, has its origin in this week's Sedra. The second sentence of the paragraph says, Ve'ohavto es Hashem Elokecha, you shall love Hashem your God, b'chol levavecha, with all your heart, v'chol nafshecha, with all your soul, v'chol meidecha, with all your might. Rashi explains what that means. Ve'ohavto, says Rashi, asei devorov me'ahavo. Serve the Ribbono Shel Olam out of love. Keep the Torah out of love of God. Eino deme oise me'ahavo, lo oise me'yiro. Because there is no comparison between one who serves God out of love and one who serves God out of fear. Compulsive avodas Hashem, compulsive service of God, cannot be compared to a service of God motivated by an inner love, by an inner desire to please Hashem. What is the difference? Rashi says an amazing thing. If a servant serves his God, he serves his master out of fear, out of compulsion, Keshehu matriach olov, there's a point at which the master imposes himself too much on the servant and causes the servant to find it heavy, and when it becomes heavy going, menicho v'heilechlo, he goes, he gives it up. So Rashi warns us that there is an inherent danger in serving the Ribbono Shel Olam from yiro, from fear, from a sense of compulsiveness. Not only is it not as good as ahava, that's the one thing which one can understand. The Rambam says it, and many people say it, that the ultimate is to serve Hashem out of love, not out of fear. But Rashi goes much further than that and says, serving God out of fear will be short-lived, because sooner or later it will become a nuisance, and there's nothing driving it. If it's not driven from within one, there comes a point where one abandons it, where one gives it up. B'chol levavcha, what does it mean to love God with all your heart? B'shnei yitzarecha. You've got to serve God with both your yitzers. B'chol levavcha means your two hearts. Serve God with all of your hearts, so to say. With your yitzer hativ and your yitzer hara. I have to understand that. What does that mean? How do you serve God with your yitzer hara? How do you serve God with your bad inclination? What does that mean? B'chol nafshecha. You must serve God even if He's taking your life. Even if you're in the process of losing your life at that moment as well, that doesn't in any way diminish your commitment to the Ribbono Shel Olam. You've got to serve God with all your material assets as well. There are some people who like their material assets more than their own lives. The Choviv Olav Migufo, they prefer it to their lives, the Kach Ne'emar V'chol Me'edecho, that's why the Torah adds. And it is that way. You'll often find people who will give their lives for Torah. If somebody comes and says, you must change your religion or I'll shoot you, You've got many, many people would say, "I'm sorry, I'm not going to change my religion. You want to shoot me, shoot me. There's nothing I can do, but I'm not going to change my religion." But that same person who will refuse to change his religion, even to save his life, when you bring him a Rosh Hashiva and you say, "There's somebody here collecting tzedakah and he would like you to help him," no, he gives you a check for 18 rand. He thinks 18 is life. That's what he does. It doesn't enter his mind to write it up for 180 rand, that he doesn't think of. For 1800 rand, 18,000 rand, that he would, but he would sacrifice his life for Torah. And when you think about it, there are many people like that. My life I sacrifice for Torah, but my money not. That not. That I want to keep for myself. So Rashi, when Rashi says, yes, she says, there are such people. Yes, lechodim, there you can find such a man who is more careful about protecting his money than he is about protecting his life when it comes to Torah. So the Torah says, b'chol modecha, not only with all your life, but even with all your money. How do we get to that kind of level? Where we're serving the Ribbono Shel Olam no matter what it costs us. And it's not a burden, because there seem to be two contradictory things. On the one hand, Rashi says, if it becomes a burden, if it becomes a drag, there comes a point at which you go. So, and how's it meant to be? So it mustn't be a drag. How is it meant to be? Even if God's taking your life, you serve Him. Even if it costs you all your money, you serve Him. That's contradictory. If it starts costing me all my life and all my money, it starts becoming heavy. So we see that it isn't so, that it's possible for a person to give his life and everything that he possesses and not find it heavy. And that's what we need to understand, that's what we need to analyze, and how do we reach that point? The Rashi in the beginning of Shir HaShirim explains the greatness of Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is the song of songs that Shlomo wrote. And in reading it in a simple way, if one reads and translates it as one goes through, it's a very beautiful love poem. And secular, non-Jewish literary critics have acclaimed it as the finest love poem in all of literature, in any language. And yet we know that can't be all that it is. Clearly it's meant to be something much more than that. It forms part of Tanakh. And Rashi brings the Chazal, that not only is it part of Tanakh and therefore more important than just a love song, but Shir Shehu Al Kol HaShirim Asher Ne'amar LaKadosh Baruch Hu Me'is Adosoi Ve'imoi Knesset Yisrael. This poem, Shir HaShirim, is greater than any poem ever written by Bnei Yisrael for the Ribbono Shel Olam, which means it includes all the poetry that we find in the Torah itself. Ha'azinu is a poem written by Moshe Rabbeinu for the Ribbono Shel Olam. As Yoshir Moshe Bnei Yisrael, the Shira that the Bnei Yisrael sang at Yam Suf, where we're told that at that time they had Nevuah, the Jewish people had prophecy. Every Jewish person who stood at Yam Suf and participated in the singing of that poem of Az Yoshir, which became part of our davening that we say every morning, Shir HaShirim is greater than that. Even though Az Yoshir is part of the Torah, is part of the Chumash, even though Hazinu is part of the Chumash, Shir HaShirim is greater. Omer Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva said, a strange thing, Lo Hayo Ha'ilom Kedai Kiyom Shinisan Bo Shir HaShirim L'Yisrael. The world was never so valuable, the world was never so worthwhile as the day on which Shir HaShirim was given to the Jewish people. That means Rabbi Akiva is saying that the day that Shir HaShirim was given to the Jewish people, in a sense, was greater than the day that the Torah was given to the Jewish people. It was greater than the day that Avram discovered the Ribbono Shel Olam. It was greater than the day of the splitting of the Red Sea. It was greater than the day of coming into Eretz Yisrael. It was greater than the day of building of the Beis Hamikdash. The day on which Bnei Yisrael were given Shir HaShirim by Shlomo HaMelech, that was the most valuable day that's ever been. Shekol HaKusuvim Kodesh, because while it is true that all of Tanakh is holy, Shir HaShirim Kodesh Kodoshim. But Shir HaShirim, the song of songs, this little love song, is Kodesh Kodoshim. It's holy beyond holiness. It is the holy of holies. Ultimate of sanctity. Omar Rabbi Elazar said, Ben Azariah, L'ma'adah Adohime, what can this be compared to? L'melech shenotal so'o chitim, like a king who took a measure of wheat when the son of the nachtoim and he gave it to the baker, Omar Loi, and he said to him, Hoitzeli kach v'kach soiles, grind this wheat into so and so much flour, kach v'kach subin, so and so much coarse flour, and kach v'kach mursin, and so and so much bran. But make me one loaf of bread that is from the finest of the finest of the flour. It's interesting, today the tendency is to go back the other way, isn't that? The fashion now is to go to the coarse flour and to the coarse bread, and we call it health bread, and so it might be more healthy. And you find people wanting to eat all these things. Here's a manupa, to have something which is highly refined, not refined artificially in the way that some of our foods are refined with all sorts of chemicals that actually remove the nutrition from it, but the refinement, to have a loaf of bread made from very fine flour, that's a kovid, that's very special bread. It might not be the most nutritious, but we've got to realize that when it comes to food, it's not only the nutritious food that is valued. Food that tastes very good, food that has a good texture, food that gives a good culinary experience, and it isn't unhealthy, is also valued a great deal. The example is this: you take this flour, get rid of the bran, get rid of the coarse flour, you sell that to the health shops for the health fanatics, and of the fine flour, refine the finest of the finest of the flour and make me a special challah, make me a special loaf of bread from that fine flour. Kach kolak suvim kodesh. In the same way, the whole of Tanakh is kodesh. It's all made from this flour. But shira shirim kodesh kodoshim. But shira shirim is that one loaf that is the product of the finest of it all. You need all of that flour to produce, you need all of that wheat to produce one small measure of the finest of fine flour. And the loaf of bread that's produced by that one small amount of finest of fine flour, that is shira shirim. So Shir HaShirim, according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, is the apex of all of Torah literature. Of the whole of the Chumash, of the whole of Tanakh, Shir HaShirim is the apex, is the pinnacle of achievement of the writings of the Tanakh. Why? Explains Rashi, Shekulo Yira Shomayim V'Kibul Ol Malchusa. Because the whole of Shir HaShirim is about, and Rashi uses two phrases, Yiras Shomayim, the fear of God, the Kibul Ol Malchusoy, and the acceptance of God's, of the yoke of God's service. Which is a strange way of talking about Shir HaShirim. That's the last thing one would say Shir HaShirim is. The first thing you would say Shir HaShirim is a love song. When you realize that it's a lot more than that, you'll say, good, it's a love song about the love of Bnei Yisrael for Hashem. So we should say it's a song which is a poem which is full of Ahavas Hashem. It's full of the love of God. And Rashi doesn't say that. Rashi says it's all of it is Yirah Shomayim, the fear of God, and the acceptance of the burden of the yoke of His kingdom. Heavy stuff. And where is it? You read through the pages of Shir HaShirim, there's nothing about fear, there's nothing about yokes, there's nothing about heaviness, burdens, responsibilities. It's all about love and romance. What does it mean? And in this we're going to understand the nature of Yirah Shomayim and the nature of Kibul Ol Malchusa. What does it really mean? We explained this morning that there are conflicting chazals and even conflicting psukim in the Torah. That if you took a collection of one type of statement from the Chumash and from Tanakh and from Chazal, and you took a collection of the other type of statement, And if I showed you the two collections, any reasonable person would assume they come from two different religions. But there is no possibility of reconciling the two different statements, the two different types of statements. On the one hand, we have statements in the Tanakh and in Chazal that seem to make it clear that we should despise all forms of material wealth and all forms of material pleasure and sensual fulfillment and gratification. All of that is nonsense. It has no place. It's irrelevant. It's unimportant. And we should actually come to a point of despising it. And in the Sifrei Musar we find a lot of that emphasis also. To totally despise it and reject it and disregard it, it's nothing. On the other hand, we come across Chazal and Psukim and Halachas that emphasize the importance of being able to appreciate the pleasures of life. And even the part that we're doing at the moment on Shabbos afternoon in the Chodesh Halvavos that makes it clear that man's ability to appreciate the Ribbono Shel Olam, man's ability to appreciate God is limited by his ability to appreciate the world. You can only appreciate the Creator by appreciating his creation. And the more the person has a capacity to enjoy the creation, the more he has a capacity to find joy in Hashem. But a person who does not have the capacity to enjoy the creation, where is he going to have capacity to enjoy Hashem? Where is his enjoyment of Hashem going to come from? What is his relationship with Hashem? And we find that a brocha can only be made if you've enjoyed the food or it's food that can be enjoyed. You can't make a brocha on food that is tasteless. I remember the first time that they gave Rebbe Yelopian millis to eat, he wouldn't make a brocha on it. He said it's animal food, it's not human food, it doesn't have a taste, it's not something for human beings to eat, and he couldn't figure out how you could make a brocha on it. And I think I've told you the story how in one of the yeshivas in which I was learning, at one point the food was terrible. And nobody seemed to be complaining about it. Terrible, terrible food. But I didn't know what to do about it, and I spoke to the other boys in the yeshiva, and they all thought I was crazy. But you come to yeshiva to eat food, you come to yeshiva to learn, the food's unimportant. And so I decided to take the food across to the Rosh Yeshiva and to ask him a shaila. Well, that was the best way to communicate. I go to the Rosh Hashanah and say the food's not nice. It doesn't sound right. So I took a bowl of food over to the Rosh Hashanah, and I said, I would like you to eat this food. And he said, why? I said, because I want to see if you make a brocha on it or not. So he said, of course I make a brocha on it. Would you have to bring me to test me to see whether I make a brocha on it? I said, no, I'm not testing you. I'm testing the food. If you make a brocha on it, I'll know that the food is tasty and there's something wrong with me. If you won't make a brocha on it, then I'll know that everybody's making a brocha levatola, because in the yeshiva they're all making brochas on the food. And that's against the din. If the food hasn't got any kind of taste, and if the food has, we don't want to be machshil the boys, that they should be making a brocha with levatola without it, so please you better paskin. Is this something you can make a brocha on or not? So he made a brocha on some other food, and then he tasted the food I brought him, and he paskin that you can't make a brocha on this food. So then it was okay, then I brought him over to tell the boys that they're making brocha levatolas, they've got to stop making brochas. If they want to eat the food, that's fine, but without a brocha. You can't attribute food like that to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's an insult. If you're happy eating it and the cook's happy eating it and you want to attribute it to the cook, fine. But don't attribute it to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's an insult. And from that time, the food started improving. Food has to be, there has to be some kind of pleasure. So why must there be pleasure? As long as it's nutritious. Who cares whether it's pleasure or not? If it were possible to make food into all the nutrition of food into little capsules, and you could just swallow the capsules like vitamin pills, you wouldn't have to make a brocha on that. Even though you would get all your nutrition, imagine you could put all a person needs into a few tablets, and he just has to pop a few pills during the day. That's fine, you should do that. But number one, you can't make a brocha on it. You can't make a brocha achrona. You can't bench. For Shabbos, that wouldn't count as a su'udah. Why not? You're getting all the nutrition fulfillment, and if food is not to be enjoyed, and if the material world is not to be enjoyed, surely that's the best thing that can possibly be. The Ribbono Shel Olam would create a way that you could eat without enjoying it. But he doesn't. And the halacha is not structured for a life without enjoyment. The halacha is structured for a life with enjoyment. And that enjoyment of life is part of the whole structure of a Torah life. But that's contrary to all sorts of other things that one reads and that one learns. And so as I said, one could actually take and make a compendium of halachas and statements of Chazal that all reflect the negativity of any kind of sensual and pleasure and enjoyment of the world, and another set of statements that all celebrate the pleasure of the world and enjoyment of the world. And if I would show the two to you, you would say, it can't be by the same author. These are two different religions. But they're not two different religions. They come from the same Torah and they come from the same Chazal. And so we have to find a way of reconciling. How is it that there are certain halachas and certain statements of Chazal that denigrate any kind of physical enjoyment and others that seem to celebrate it? What we need to understand is that the intention of the Ribbono Shel Olam is that we do experience a sensual form of ecstasy. The human being has a capacity to achieve enormous levels of pleasure and enjoyment, far in excess of what the animal is capable of achieving. An animal can achieve gratification. An animal can have a need which is gratified. When an animal is hungry and he eats, that need is gratified and he has a certain pleasure from that, but that's as much as he can get. The animal doesn't have the capacity for pleasure that the human being does. And that capacity for pleasure is a capacity given to us by the Ribbono Shel Olam, and it's part of the spiritual part of being a human being, not part of the physical and purely sensual part of being a human being. And perhaps I need to be careful to define this term sensual. In the normal sense of the word, sensual means those pleasures that are derived from the human being's five senses. He enjoys the smell, he enjoys the taste, he enjoys the touch of something, he enjoys the sound of something, he enjoys the sight of something. That's a sensual pleasure. But we need to understand that those senses that are located in our bodies, because the five senses, the ability to sense the stimuli which cause that pleasure, is located in our bodies, true. But the pleasure itself is not only located in our bodies. The pleasure we're able to get from that is located much deeper. That's located already in our neshamas. That's an intellectual thing, it's a spiritual thing. The pleasure that one gets from visual aesthetics. You look at a beautiful painting or you look at a beautiful sight, an animal gets no pleasure from that. And a human being gets sensual pleasure from that. It actually elevates it, it makes him feel good inside. Something that he's seeing. So although he's using his eye, which is an external limb, in order to be able to relate to the object, but the pleasure he gets from that is not a physical pleasure. And so we've got to be careful when we talk about sensual pleasures as being physical. That's not right. Sensual pleasures are spiritual pleasures that the human being derives from physical stimuli. But it's a spiritual pleasure, not a physical pleasure. When you listen to fine music, that's not a physical pleasure. The music is, does the dog enjoy music? Does the cat enjoy music? Not capable of it. To find ecstasy, to find unbelievable fulfillment and pleasure in the sounds, in tones and sounds, not possible. So although we're using the ear to pick up those sounds, the pleasure we're getting is not physical, the pleasure we're getting is spiritual. And so it is with smell. And so it is, Chazal say that the smell is the closest to a spiritual pleasure. That's because there even the stimulus is almost spiritual. Even the stimulus is something that can't really be touched, that can't be seen. It's the closest sense to something purely spiritual. And the same applies to taste. Although we think taste is entirely physical, it's not. There again, animals don't enjoy taste. It's interesting how the marketers of dog food market it as if it were they were marketing to human beings. The flavor this and that flavor and how good it is, and you see the adverts of the dog enjoying the flavor. The dog doesn't know the difference. Not at all. The dog doesn't know the difference. But the marketers know that the human beings buy the dog food, and the marketers know that human beings like to think that their dogs are also human, and so they appeal to the human in the animal, or to the animal in the human, whatever it is. It doesn't make much difference. And so they confuse us and make us think that that's what the dog likes. The dog couldn't care less. whether the epal is flavored with steak or with liver or isn't flavored at all. It makes absolutely no difference. When he's hungry, he eats. And when he's not hungry, he doesn't eat. No matter how good the flavor is and how good it tastes, he doesn't eat if he's not hungry. That's why you can see a delicious, fat, beautiful impala walk past a lion's nose when the lion's not hungry. And you must imagine, you must know, if the lion functioned like a human being, when an impala walked past his nose, that would be like waving a stake in front of your nose just before Yom Kippur's out. It wouldn't be easy for a human being to resist it, to resist the equivalent. The lion has no yetzahora at all, and the buck knows it. If he's not hungry, he won't move, no matter how delicious. Human beings aren't like that. When we're not hungry, if you bring something delicious, we will eat it. Why? Because we don't just eat to satisfy our hunger. We eat for the culinary experience. That's what a human being does. A human being relates to taste, because taste is something human, it's not something animal. So although we think that when we're eating we're doing something very animal, if the food has no taste, then taka, it's animal. That's the whole point. That's why we can't make a brocha. That's why I got so upset in that particular yeshiva. Because the boys thought, when the Rosh Yeshiva called them in and said, how come you've never complained about the food before? And they said to him, Rosh Yeshiva, you know, we came here to learn Torah, not to eat food. We don't even notice if the food is nice or not. It's not important to us. Our minds are in Torah. And I'll never forget the Rosh Yeshiva's answer. He says, I teach Torah to human beings, not to angels. You'd better find yourselves another yeshiva. Because that's not human. Not to notice what you're eating, that's not human. If you're eating food that is ghastly, you think that's a very human spiritual thing. I don't need food. I'm on such a level, the food's not important. If you're eating food that has no taste, that's an animal action, not a spiritual action. It's the animal that eats food that has no taste and doesn't notice the difference. The human being demands taste, expects taste, enjoys taste, because that's human. And that's what he's saying the brocha on. He's not saying the brocha on filling his stomach. He's not saying the brocha on providing the nutrition. He's saying the brocha on the taste, on the variety, on the texture, on the experience of eating. That's what he's saying the brocha on. And so with the sense of touch, each one of the senses, it's an external physical stimulus. But the ecstasy, the pleasure, is a spiritual pleasure, not a physical pleasure. And why does the Ribbono Shel Olam give us that? Because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to find that ecstasy in Him. The Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to find that total involvement and that total ecstasy in Him. Let's come back to the love image. What senses do a loving couple use in their relationship? Think about it for a moment. What senses come into play if the relationship between a loving couple is as that relationship ought to be? Is there a sense of touch? Yes. Is there a sense of smell? Yes, otherwise the perfume companies wouldn't make a living. Is there a sense of the visual? Yes. Is there a sense of the audio? Does one use one's ears? Yes. People have fallen in love with a voice without even seeing the person. Sometimes people have fallen in love over the telephone. It can happen. We use our voice as well. And we use our sense of taste as well. Everything comes into that relationship. When a human being, when two people are relating to one another, when a man and a woman are relating to one another, the way they're meant to, and in a proper love relationship, all five senses are functioning. And that's probably the only situation in which all five senses are focused on one object of pleasure. All the other objects of pleasure, it's one. You're eating something, it's your taste and your smell. You're touching something, it's your sense of feeling. You're looking at a beautiful painting, it's your sense of vision, it's your eyes. It's possibly the only experience that entails the utilization, the focusing of all of the person's five senses on one object of pleasure, is in the relationship of love between a man and his wife. And that's the way that Ribbono Shel Olam wants us to relate to him. But we've got to be able to focus all our five senses on the Ribbono Shel Olam and find the pleasure that comes from the combination and the synthesis of all five senses focused on one object, that object being the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. That's what he wants us to reach. That's what he wants us to get to. The purpose of giving us the power of pleasure is not, as other religions have figured out, that it's to distract us. The pleasure is there to tempt us. That pleasure is there only for the Yetzer Hara. No. pleasure is there because it needs to be incorporated and used in the way we experience the Ribono Shel'Olam. What we've got to be careful not to do is not to misuse it. Not to use it only for its lowest levels and not to achieve the higher levels that one has to achieve in it. For example, if you have a child, let's say, that has musical talent, and the parents buy a piano for the child, and they hire a teacher for the child. And the child says, "What is the piano for?" The teacher explains, "The piano is to play on." "What can you play on it?" So the teacher teaches the child to play Ba Ba Black Sheep on the piano. The child plays, practices a few times, and he can play Ba Ba Black Sheep beautifully on the piano. And he says to his parents, "I don't need the teacher anymore. You got me the piano to play, I can play Ba Ba Black Sheep." And the child goes through, becomes 10 years old, 15 years old, 20 years old, 25 years old, and all he can play day and night is Ba Ba Black Sheep on the piano. That's what he's using it for. And the parents are heartbroken. There was such talent in the child, and all he can play is Ba Ba Black Sheep. The Ribono Shel'Olam gives us koichos, he gives us powers, which he wants us to use to achieve unbelievable heights. But in order to get there, we have to play Ba Ba Black Sheep first. But if we never get beyond that, we've lost the opportunity, we've lost the ability. And so people who see the pleasures in their physical expressions and manifestations as the ultimate, that's all that they feel, that's all that they're able to reach, they're in the Baba Black Sheep stage. They're unable to get beyond that. And they leave aside the magnificent achievements possible if one would be able to apply that focus to greater heights and levels of achieving a sensual relationship with the Ribono Shel'Olam. And so we've got to say that the way the Torah sees our lives is not a life in which we deny physical pleasure and opt for a spiritual existence instead. And we have to be very careful, as I mentioned this morning, to create for ourselves an artificial life where pleasure and fun has no role. That's already a serious sickness. When you see a person going through his life without the capacity for enjoyment, without the ability to laugh, without the ability to have pleasure, that's already a serious handicap. But there's something more serious than that. When the person persuades himself that his grey, dull existence is in fact ecstatic, that he's really having a good time, that's even more serious. And one has to be very careful when one watches the process of young people becoming frum nowadays. The very first thing that happens when a person becomes frum is, even before he's keeping kashrus or Shabbos properly, the first thing that happens is he starts taking his tzitzis out. He wears his tzitzis out. The next thing that happens is probably, it varies, different people then follow different processes. And they start looking sloppy, that comes quite soon afterwards. And eventually they come to Shabbos, to the less important things, kashrus and things like that, that also starts coming. Then very high levels of kashrus start coming, and higher levels of Shabbos start coming, but quite early in the process is the loss of of sense of humor and the loss of capacity to have pleasure. That comes quite early in the process of becoming frum. When all of a sudden you realize a guy who used to really be quite a lot of fun to have around, or a girl who used to be quite a lot of fun to have around, all of a sudden is dull and boring. And that the possibility of finding joy and pleasure and variety and diversity in the experiences of life is something that becomes less and less important. And that ought not to be. That's not what is meant to be at all. It's not a question of substituting the pleasure of life with a dull experience of being frum or being religious and persuading oneself that that in fact is true pleasure, that in fact is true fun. That's not what it's meant to be. What it's meant to be is a slow substitution of the source of pleasure. That's all that changes. The pleasure remains the same. In fact, the process of the pleasure gets greater and greater as one raises one's level in Yiddishkeit and as one develops oneself. The pleasure gets greater. All that changes as one moves along is the source of pleasure changes. Instead of getting all of one's pleasure from physical things, one starts getting a certain amount of it from spiritual things as well. And as one develops, the proportion begins to alter. More and more has a spiritual source, and less of it has a physical source. But not because there's a diminishment of pleasure, and not because one's fooling oneself into thinking one's having pleasure when one isn't having pleasure, but because truly there's a greater sense of pleasure as one goes through the spiritual experiences. From them one's able to draw absolutely on that pleasure. But just as one has to prepare oneself for that by virtue of understanding the Torah and understanding the mitzvahs and knowing how to perform them and what needs to be done, so at the same time one has to be developing one's capacity for pleasure. And within the framework of the Torah, obviously, within the framework of halacha, one has to be able to develop one's ability to find pleasure, because a human being who has an undeveloped capacity for pleasure will not be able to find pleasure in spiritual things, will not be able to find pleasure in the Torah, will not be able to find pleasure in the Ribbono Shel Olam. And so we need to understand that there are certain statements of Chazal that describe life as it could be in the ideal. And there are other statements of Chazal that describe life as it needs to be in the interim. Because we need to know both. It's necessary to know what the ideal could look like and should look like, and it's necessary to know what the reality is. A life, a religious life that concentrates only on the ideal, ensures that one will never get to the ideal. Because if you look only at the ideal and you don't have the possibility of actually translating that ideal into a reality, you don't know how to do so. Nothing's going to come of it at all. I had the opportunity very recently to have a look at that place that Saul Kirzner built in Baputotswana, the Lost City. That's an amazing place. It's an absolutely amazing place. There are two things that are amazing. And what's really amazing is the two together. Each one on its own wouldn't be amazing. The first is the imagination. The imagination, the vision, to think of such a thing in such a place. That's an unbelievable experience, to be exposed to an imagination gone wild. Just like a little child imagining in a most delightful, unrestricted sort of way. But there are lots of people who've got imagination. There are lots of people who've got vision. There are lots of people who've got good ideas. But to be able to make it work, to be able to take an idea like that and make a business out of it, that's unbelievable. And it's necessary for everybody to go and experience that. Everybody should see that. Because I can't think of a better example anywhere in the world of the capacity of the human being to imagine something and translate that imagination into a real thing, into something that works. And so it is, lahavdil, when it comes to Avodas Hashem. You need to have your eye on that ideal. You need to know what the end looks like. But you need to know something else as well, how to get there. It's all very well to live in a dream world. But one needs to know how to get there. What are the practical steps in order to get there? It's all very well to be bogged down in the practical steps and to forget the dream world. We won't get there either. What the Torah wants from us is to have a vision at all times of birth, to be able to see the dream world in front of us and that it's possible, it can be attained. And at the same time to be able to see the reality, the steps that need to be taken in order to get there. The dream world, the one that can be attained, but it's a dream world, it's an ideal, it's a vision, is one where the human being is totally enraptured in the Ribbono Shel Olam, and all the sources of his physical pleasure come from that. Come from his relationship with the Ribbono Shel Olam. To the point that he doesn't need any kind of physical input. That's the ideal. We've got the case that I've learned with the ladies this morning, we've learned in this year, I think before, where there's a discussion in the Gemara, in Gemara Sota, Daf Samech Dalet, I think it is, in Gemara Yevomis, Daf Samech Dalet, where the Gemara discusses how serious is it for a person not to have children, to opt not to have children, to voluntarily opt not to have children. So one man almost says it's like, it's murder. You're depriving the world of potential life. Another mandor almost says you're diminishing God's presence in the world, because people are created in the image of God, and the less people there are, the less image of God there is. So you're diminishing God's image. And Ben Azai comes along and he says it's both. You're murdering, you're depriving people of potential life, and you're depriving people of the opportunity of being exposed to godliness. And they turn on Ben Azai and they say, that's a fine thing for you to say. How can you say such a thing? Some people give nice droshes, they give nice shiurim, and they keep what they say, they practice what they preach. Some people practice, but they can't preach, they don't have the talent to preach. But you preach and you don't practice, that's the worst of the lot. You never got married, Ben Azza. You opted not to have children. How can you say, you and you take the most serious view of everybody regarding this thing of not opting not to have children. Ben Azza says, what can I do? I fell in love. Fell in love? So I fell in love with the Torah. There was no time to marry any woman. There was no time for family life. I fell in love with the Torah. So what is Ben Azza saying? That it is possible for the human to find total fulfillment, marital fulfillment. That's what he means. Choshko nafshi batera. All my passions, all my senses were fulfilled in my relationship with the Torah. There was no place for marriage. There was no need for marriage. That's possible. That's in a sense that vision that one can become so enraptured in the, with the Ribbono Shel Olam that there's no place for anything else. But that's not the way that most of us can go. That's not an option. Why not? It says so in the Gemara. Ben Azai was a great tzaddik. Why don't we all follow Ben Azai's way? Because that's living the dream without understanding the reality. The reality is we can't find our pleasures totally in the Ribbono Shel Olam because we're not on that level. If we can't find our pleasures totally in the Ribbono Shel Olam, we have to find them in the interim in the other ways that the Torah allows us to do so. I'll give you another example. You can find a person who's a very great Talmid Chacham and who is able to find all his intellectual and artistic input and stimulation from the Torah. His understanding of the Torah is so deep and so complex and so fulfilling, and it's rich, it's multi-dimensional. That whatever mathematics he needs, he can get from the Torah. Whatever science he needs, he can get from the Torah. Whatever art he needs, he can get from the Torah. That's the level on which he's operating. So for such a person to waste time reading Shakespeare, or anybody else for that matter, would be a terrible tragedy. He has to spend every minute he's got in Torah because there's nothing that can give him as much as the Torah can give him. Anything else would be a waste of time. So imagine if an ordinary person meets this person and sees that he doesn't spend a moment, he doesn't read anything else, he doesn't look at anything else, he doesn't talk about anything else. So, I've got to do the same. He's a great man, I've got to do the same. It isn't so. If one isn't on the level where one's able to get all one's input from Torah, one has to get the input meanwhile. If one isn't getting the input meanwhile, where is it going to come from? That's why one has to be very careful. You find this also in the process of becoming religious, that Baalei Teshuva will often, first and foremost, cut off sources of intellectual stimulus. They'll stop their university course to go to yeshiva. Fine, very nice. They'll stop reading any kind of secular books because they're now learning Torah. And they're 21 or 22 or 25. On what level are they learning Torah? On the level of a 6-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old. So where's their intellectual input coming from? So they land up with the most critical years of their intellectual development, the years of their early 20s, late teens and early 20s, which is the most critical time for intellectual development. They spend that without any intellectual input. They're learning aleph beis, they're learning simple things in Torah which aren't yet stimulating their intellect because they don't have the technical capacity yet to learn on that level, and they've cut off other areas of stimulus. How careful one has to be. We don't cut anything off if it's kosher. It's treif, of course we cut it off. But anything that's kosher, we don't cut off until it can be substituted by sources of kedusha and tahara. Then yes, then we slowly start substituting. Then you don't need the other stuff. Then the other stuff starts becoming trivial, it starts becoming superficial when you're able to get it all from Torah. But until you're able to get it all from Torah, there needs to be that other form of stimulus. We have to be very careful not to cut off our capacity to develop richness and to develop stimulus and to develop enjoyment and fulfillment and fun and pleasure before we're able to find that fulfillment in other areas. Find a person, for example, Shabbos can happen. The person starts keeping Shabbos too early. How can it happen, such a thing happen? Before a person knows anything, imagine a situation that you've got somebody who lives in, and we've had such cases, la'alocha, you have a person who lives out in Midrand or somewhere, there's no shul anywhere near, no Jews anywhere near, and all of a sudden he learns about Shabbos. So he decides he wants to start keeping Shabbos. But let's say he can't get away for Shabbos, he's got to stay in that part of the world, so what does he do on Shabbos? He doesn't know how to make Kiddush, he doesn't know how to learn Chumash, he doesn't know anything. And he also hears that you mustn't read secular things. And he also hears that all these things you mustn't do. So he sits in his house for 25 hours. He sits and does nothing. But he's keeping Shabbos? That's not keeping Shabbos. He's not ready yet to be keeping Shabbos. Because he's taking an entire day and wiping it out. That's not Shabbos. Shabbos is not wiping things out. Shabbos is not the wiping out of experience. Shabbos is the enriching of experience. And so it is with every aspect and with every dimension of Torah. There is nothing in Torah that is designed to extinguish experience. Everything in Torah is designed to enrich experience. And until we ready that is the image used in Shir HaShirim, and then let's go back to the Shema. What is the love relationship in Shir HaShirim? I explained to the ladies this morning, if you would take a woman and you would say to her, I've got a job for you, and it's a job that the thousands of other, hundreds of thousands, millions of other women seem to crave for, and I'm going to offer you the job. What's the job? Well, there's this family, there's a man and he has 6 children of varying ages, and what you've got to do is you've got to look after this family. You've got to cook for them, and you've got to bake for them, and you've got to sew their clothes, and you've got to do their homework with the children, and you've got to look after them when they're sick, and you've got to, that will be the job. She says, yes. And the pay? So the pay is free board and lodging, free clothes, and occasionally a gift for Yom Tov. That's the pay. She'll say, are you off your mind? Have you lost your head completely? And he says, but look how many women want to do this. Look at take any newspaper and look at the engagement columns. See, every day women are getting engaged. Every day more and more women, every day women. What are they going to do? Ask them, phone them up and ask them what they're doing and how much they're going to get paid for it. And you'll see it's the same. They're going to take on a family. They're going to have children. They're going to care for the children. All the things I described to you, and they're not going to get paid for it. What's the difference? You can do the same with a man. Works the other way around too. Take a man and tell him, look, no, you're only a young man and you're only earning a few hundred rand a month, but how about splitting that between you and someone else? Splitting it? And how am I going to manage? Well, I'll tell you what. You don't really have to split it. The other person can live with you, so you save rent right away. Two, instead of paying rent for two people, you'll pay only one rent. Yes, isn't it? And what else? What else is in it for me? Well, how about that person will do your cooking for you? But everything you have is okay. You might persuade them. Maybe it's an idea. And you say, but you need to understand, in a couple of years' time, we'll add another one. And a few years later, we'll add another one. Soon there'll be 5 or 6 of you, 7 of you. And you'll have to pay for the education of all of them. And he says, one second. And who'll be working? Who'll be earning the money? So just you. And the others? No. They're there to eat. They're there to enjoy themselves. They're there to be educated. You have to pay for it all. And you know what? When they want to get married and they want to go to Kolo for a few years, you pay for that too. You support them and their wives. He says, you mean to say in a few years' time, I might be supporting 15 people? You say, yes. Jump in the lake. Forget it. Yet people do it. And look in the engagement columns and you'll find that for every girl that's getting engaged, there's a boy who's doing it as well. That's love. Love takes the most unacceptable of tasks and makes them the most delightful pleasures. That's what love does. And that's what Shir HaShirim is about. Shir HaShirim is a description of what the fear, what Yirat Shamayim and Kibul Ol Malchuso, the awe of Hashem and taking on the responsibility of His kingdom, that yoke, that responsibility, what it's meant to be like. It's meant to be like a love poem. It's meant to be romantic. It's meant to be pleasurable. It's meant to be fun. It's meant to be ecstatic. And if it isn't, it isn't proper Yirat Shamayim. If it isn't, it isn't proper Kibul Ol Malchuso. And that's why, says Rashi, Chazal say that Shir HaShirim is the pinnacle of the whole of Torah. Because if you remove Shir HaShirim from the Torah becomes a bind. The Torah becomes a burden. It's like taking love out of marriage. What happens when you take love out of marriage? Both parties are left with such a bind and with such a burden that they can't understand what got into them in the first place. Take Shir HaShirim out of the relationship between Klal Yisrael and God. Take that love relationship out, and what are you left with? With a burden. Just with a heavy responsibility, with a heavy burden. Do this or else. That is the lovely example that I remember my father used to tell me when I was a little child. Imagine a person being told, you've got to walk along a path, The path is very, very narrow. It's only a few inches wide, and it's 3 kilometers long. And on each side of the path is barbed wire, but not like old-fashioned barbed wire. Like the new barbed wire they've got. You know those coils of stuff that they put on the fences in Johannesburg? What's it called?
Razor wire.
Razor wire, yeah, razor wire. On both sides. If you walk absolutely straight, and you don't lose your balance, and you don't move anywhere, it's designed in such a way that you can get from one end to the other without hurting yourself at all. Try it. And we get the person, and he goes and he starts walking one foot in front of the other, and he looks both ways, the next foot, and slowly, slowly, the sweat is pouring down his face, and he's shivering and he's trembling, and eventually he comes out the other side. What a nightmare. Never again. Never again. We take the same person, and we take the same path, same width, same length, but no barbed wire. Just on each side of the this little path, there's the most beautiful bed of exotic flowers. Every flower, there's only one like it in the world. These are collector's pieces. Most beautiful. The smell of the flowers, the sight of the flowers. And we tell him, one step off the path, and you trample on these flowers, and you've spoilt them, you've spoilt the whole bed. Now see if you can walk from one side to the other. And in the same way he walks, and he walks carefully, and he puts one foot in the other, and he's careful not to wobble and not to shake. And he comes out to the other end, and what's on his face? A smile. Ah, I did it. Look at that. Look at the flowers, untouched. That's the difference between serving Hashem with Avo and serving Hashem with Yiras. It's the same action. One is fun, a pleasure, a challenge, beautiful, enjoyment. And one is a bind, a burden, a responsibility, heavy, negative. And Rashi says, Yira Shemayim v'kibul ol malchusoy has to be seen through the glass of Shira Shirim. That's how you have to see it. Because without that, and now we can move to the Rashi on our parasha, the Rashi in the Shema, without that, Ha'isa etzel rabo me'yira, if you do it with Yira, not through the Shira Shirim route, but pure fear. Keshehu matriach olov me'nicho v'hilichloy. There comes a time when you say, enough, I don't want this anymore. And you leave the Ribbono Shel Olam in one form or another. When one loses that interest and that commitment, because it was an external compulsion that was pushing one along, it wasn't an internal avo, it wasn't the love of Hashem. And so we asked, how do we get to that level of b'chol levovcho, b'chol nafshecho, b'chol meridecho, loving Hashem? The answer is simple. When a person is in love, would he give his life for his beloved? Yeah. Look at all the love songs and look at all the love poetry. Of course he would. When a person is in love, would he give of all of his money to his beloved? Of course he does. Of course he would. That's why people get married. Nothing is too much. Nothing is too burdensome. Nothing is too much of a sacrifice. If it starts with the Ahavto es Hashem Elokecha, if it starts with loving the Ribbono Shel Olam, then everything that the person does and everything that the person commits himself to is only a pleasure. It's the greatest joy in his life. And that's the level to which we're meant to get. And where does that come from? It comes from the first sentence of the Shema. How does one get it? Shema Yisrael. The first condition is understand. Shema. Listen. Absorb. Hear. Understand. Hashem Elokeinu. Hashem Echad. There are two things you need to know about Hashem. The one is His ours. The other is His unique. When you look at a love relationship, the same thing applies. Say to a person, says, I'm in love. Who are you in love with? I'm in love with Princess Diana. But she's not yours. So what kind of love is that? That's not what it all is. The first thing in love is, I'm in love with this person and they're mine. But there needs to be another dimension to it too. So you're in love with them. And what's special about them? There are hundreds like that person. The person who's in love doesn't believe that there's another one like that person. That's part of what being in love is. To understand two things simultaneously. That person is unique, and he or she is committed to me. That's what it is. And that's what needs to be in the relationship to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Shema Yisrael, when we've listened and understood clearly two things. That number one, Hashem is Elokeinu. That Hashem is ours. He doesn't belong to the other nations. He doesn't relate to the other nations the way He relates to us. He's ours. Not only are we His. Yes, we're His as well, but that's not what we say in the Shema. Hashem Elokeinu, He's ours. Hashem Echad, and He's unique. Then there can be the beginning of a love relationship. And I want to take that one step further in understanding the Echad. Very briefly, in the next sentence of Shir HaShirim, Shlomo HaMelech says, Yeshokeini min Ashikos pihu, may He, Hashem, kiss me with the kisses of His mouth. Ki tovim dodecho miyoyin, because your love is better than wine. And wine is the image of all forms of sensuality. That there is nothing sensual that is as good, there is nothing that is physical, that has as much sensual joy as your love, Hashem. And again, Rashi, we don't have time to develop the whole idea. We'll do that at the later shiur next week. But meanwhile, what we can do this evening is Rashi saying, we have trust that Hashem will appear to us that Hashem will appear to us to explain the underlying principle of the reasons of the Torah and the secret depths of the hidden aspects of Torah. And that is the greatest intimacy. As far as intimacy between us and Hashem is concerned, when we're able to understand the depths of the Torah, of Hashem's will and how Hashem operates and how Hashem thinks and how Hashem functions, that's the point at which we achieve intimacy with the Ribbono Shel Olam. But look at the words of Rashi carefully. He does not say, Leva'el Lohem, to teach Bnei Yisrael, Soidos Ta'ameho, the foundations of the reasons of the Torah. Soid is in the singular. So there's one underlying principle that explains all the reasons of the Torah. Umistar tzefunosel. It doesn't say umistaros tzefunosel, the hidden aspects of its secrets. It doesn't say that. Umistar, the secret. There are certain principles of the Torah. The Torah is structured like a tree. And there are different branches, and one can follow down and get to fundamental principles and more fundamental principles and more fundamental principles. But we have to be able to penetrate to the trunk of the tree and understand the soy, that which underlies every other aspect of the Torah. And when we're able to understand that, then we've got a uniqueness, then we have a love with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Because that's how love operates. To be able to take another human being and understand the essential principle that explains every aspect of his personality, when one has been able to perceive that, and to find that one's own essential principles merge with that person's. Not that one part of the person merges with one part. They like a particular thing and I like a particular thing, so we can be in love. That's not what it is. But we have been able to get to an understanding of the essence of that person and an understanding of my essence, and those two essences can join together. Then there's a love relationship. And that's the Shema Yisrael. Listen, Yisrael. Hashem Elokeinu. Hashem is our Ribbono Shel Olam. Hashem Echad, we've got to get to that oneness where we understand the uniqueness of every aspect of the Ribbono Shel Olam's activities, and we can find the common principle and we can relate to that fundamental principle. Then we're able to establish a relationship which is the Ahavto es Hashem Elokecho. Then one's able to love the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when we're involved in a relationship of love, it involves all of our hearts, b'shnei yitzorecho, our yetzer tov and our yetzer hara. What is our yetzer hara? Our yetzer hara, there's no such thing as a yetzer hara, really. Yetzer hara means our evil inclination, but it's the same word, yetzer. Yetzer tov and yetzer ra. There is a part of us, a creative part of us, a creative drive and a creative urge. That's what yetzer means, from yetziro, the desire to create. When we're fulfilling that creative drive constructively, it's a yetzer tov. And when we're frustrated and try to find other outlets for it, it's a yetzer hara. We're destructive. We misuse the creative drive. The service of Hashem, when it's va'ahavta, when there's a love of the Ribbono Shel Olam, when it's a love relationship, we use our entire creative drives for the Ribbono Shel Olam. There is no yetzer hara. The yetzer tov and the yetzer hara, the sensuality of the person as well as the spirituality of the person, are all focused on the Ribbono Shel Olam. And when we're serving the Ribbono Shel Olam with our sensuality and with our spirituality, then it's b'chol levavcho, b'chol nafshecho. Not only is it with all our heart, but also with all our life, even if we're losing our life. Not only is it with all our life, but it's also b'chol moedecho. For those of us who find it harder to part with money than to part with our life, even b'chol moedecho, it's nothing for us to make a sacrifice for the Ribbono Shel Olam, a physical sacrifice, a material sacrifice, an emotional sacrifice, whatever it is. our relationship with the Ribbono Shel is so sensual, so deep, so intense and so intimate that nothing that he asks of us is too much. That whatever he asks of us is something we're only too happy to give, in that our relationship is one of oise, not oise miyiro, not one who does out of fear, but of oise miahavo, a fulfillment of the relationship between Klal Yisrael, which is a relationship of love, a relationship of ahavo.